Welcome to Season 3 of the Spotlight Series, Don't Just Survive, Thrive. Season 1 was launched to help people through the pandemic by talking to a variety of experts about topics such as psychology, finance and health. Season 2 focused on more work-related issues, including HR, marketing and leadership. Now it is time for Season 3. Season 3 is centred on the IT industry, specifically tech startups. There are also career spotlights where I talk to senior IT people about the secrets to their impressive career journeys. My name is Nicholas Steele, founder of JJP Talent Solutions, an Australian IT recruitment company. For over 20 years, I've helped tech startups and innovative SMEs to attract, recruit, and retain technical talent. I hope you enjoy listening.
I'm delighted to introduce Evan Kumak. Evan is based in San Francisco and is the CEO of Finn, a company shaping the future of work, which was founded by former Facebook VP Sam Lesson and Venmo co-founder Andrew Cortina. Prior to Finn, Evan was general manager at Twilio, which I hope I'm pronouncing that correctly, joining in 2011 as one of the organization's early employees. Evan, thank you for joining me on Season 3, Episode 25 of the Spotlight Series, Don't Just Survive, Thrive.
Thank you for having me.
My pleasure, and lovely to meet you in sunny San Francisco. So,
I'm actually in very sunny Arizona right now.
Ah, right.
Very, very sunny Arizona for anyone who's never been here. It's notoriously sunny.
Yes. Okay. So do you live in Arizona then rather than San Francisco?
No, I, like many people, I actually moved. Well, I didn't really move. I started spending more time outside of San Francisco when COVID lockdowns became more intense. And I live most of my time at Lake Tahoe, California. And I'm just down here for a few months for the winter.
Okay, excellent. Well, enjoy. So if we could start by you telling me a little bit more about your background and career history.
Sure. Yeah, I grew up in New Zealand in a town called Paraparaumu, which is about 45 minutes north of Wellington. And it's not exactly known for its bustling technology industry, although actually there's a lot of talent there these days, but not so much when I was growing up there, I do have to say that. So I studied in New Zealand. I went to Victoria University in Wellington, and then pretty quickly started working in the software industry. And there wasn't as much choice then. This was about 12, 13, maybe more like 15 years ago. And there wasn't as much choice in terms of the software landscape. There wasn't as many startups, that's for sure. There wasn't as many SaaS companies. In fact, there was really no SaaS companies there at that time. Xero was just getting started. And so I ended up working for the government. Basically, I worked for a company called NEC, which is a Japanese multinational technology company. But my role was really creating technology for the New Zealand Police Department, doing fingerprint identification technology and other biometric identification technology. And I kind of knew that I didn't really want to be doing that. It was pretty awesome, actually. I kind of look back now and I'm like, wow, that was a cool job. But the thing that I think that made it cool was kind of what makes all jobs in New Zealand cool, which is there was four people or something working on this gigantic system. And so you got to really do everything. You might be designing user interfaces in the morning and installing servers in the afternoon, which is just not something you get to do at a big company. And so I had it in mind, like I wanted to come to Silicon Valley for a long time. And then one day I just got on a plane and flew to San Francisco. This was pretty close to the height of what you might describe as the Web 2 boom. So around 2010, end of 2010. And I made a very short list of companies that I really wanted to work at. One of them was a company called Twilio, which was very small at the time. It was about to raise a Series B financing. For folks who don't know Twilio, it's now a very large organization. You have to look it up, but I do remember being very surprised when I looked at it for the first time on the Fortune 500 list, and it was a bigger company than Ford Motor Company. That was an interesting feeling. by market capitalization, let's say. And yeah, so it was a really fun ride. And I think, you know, a lot of that stuff that I mentioned from working in a small country at a big company is actually not that different to working at a small company in a big country. I think those skills actually translate surprisingly well. So that was a kick.
Fantastic. And New Zealand to San Francisco are two completely different environments. And so you flew out to San Francisco with no job, just your suitcase. What was the story there?
Yeah, I mean, that's basically it. I borrowed some money from my mom, which, you know, it's not like she had a lot of, so I appreciate that to this day. And just started doing the rounds when I got here. It was the companies I was super excited about were Dropbox, which of course people know, and then Heroku, which was acquired by Salesforce soon after, and Twilio, and then there was a couple of others that went out of business, as most software startups do. So I think in terms of the choice that I made, I probably couldn't have made a better choice there. It was. I think I've been talking to friends recently who are looking for work in the tech industry in Europe in particular. And like, despite how hot it is there and how hungry they are for talent, it's really hard to comprehend how hungry and willing software companies are in the United States are to hire. I mean, it's like, if you can come in and show that you're good, it's just such a different environment. So I think it took me, you know, like 3 weeks to figure all that out and to start work. And yeah, it was just a fun 10-year ride from there.
That's fantastic. So did you knock on the doors? Did you ring them? Yes. Did you email them?
My old boss always teases me that I showed up at Twilio with my suitcase, which isn't actually true, although it wasn't like that far from untrue. So Twilio's product is like API focused, is developer focused. So I just went to a coffee shop one day and wrote a bunch of applications, essentially demos that use their technology. And then I think I just emailed basically and said, hey, you know, I'd love to come talk to you about some role that was on the website, but essentially like just anything. I just want to talk to you guys about anything. And you know, ended up meeting the CEO and just showing him the demos that I'd created. And, you know, we had a good chat about the industry and where the company saw itself going and how he wanted to run the company and so on and so forth. And that's another thing I think that's really important when you, I realize this now that I'm CEO of a smaller company. My company's a little bigger than Twilio was when I joined, but not much. Having someone come in the door who just understands what you're doing is like worth way more than almost any qualification. It can be, I don't want to use the word lonely, it's the wrong word, but there's a constant sense of almost doubt combined with this sort of exuberant enthusiasm. Mm-hmm. But when someone comes in and says, hey, I understand exactly what you're doing and I want to help you, it's a very compelling proposition from a hiring perspective.
So like a breath of fresh air.
It's like, oh, look, there's another person that wants to jump on board with this crazy thing that we're doing. And, I think as we got bigger in that company, for example, you would notice the resumes change at every like major event along the company's progression. So you raise Series C financing, Series D financing, you go public, like you have your IPO, whatever it is. And every single time you now get like a much more pedigree, much less risk tolerant, at least in my perspective, sort of cohort of applicants. But early on, it really is in large part like a fairly ragtag bunch that tends to sort of identify with a small company that's doing something relatively esoteric. And so I think like if you can resonate with a team like that, it's a big leg up.
Do you know River City Labs in Brisbane?
I don't.
They're a tech startup incubator. So it's all at that kind of early stage where bringing people on board, where people want that kind of crazy vision and all that kind of aspect. And I love your story as well about being bold. You didn't go in at the mid-level. You went to the CEO level. And
well, he didn't exactly pick up the phone, but I did get there eventually after talking to a few other folks. But I think it's not that hard to, like, so for example, you know, my company now is about 50 people. And if someone emails me with a compelling story and resume and says, I really want to work at your company, you know, the least I'm going to do is introduce them to the, you know, the relative functional leader and say, hey, you should talk to this person. Just because of that, what I mentioned, that idea that having people come on board who really understand what you're doing is, I think, at least as valuable or more valuable than having people come on board who don't quite necessarily get what you're doing, but they're really otherwise really intelligent or otherwise really experienced. Of course, those things become a little bit of a prerequisite, especially for certain domain type jobs like finance. But having someone who really gets what you're doing is a real shortcut in like getting where you're going and getting people productive.
That's really, really great advice for people when they're trying to break in there and what have you, particularly if you're moving to a new country as well, which in Australia, for example, our borders are closed, but they go open up. Well, they're opening up slowly, but there are going to be people coming here and making themselves known in the market. And tell me a little bit more about that transition from a major corporate like NEC and then going to an early stage tech startup like Twilio. I can't pronounce it correctly.
Oh, yeah.
So tell me a little bit more about that.
Honestly, I you know, it's probably a bad example because I was working for NEC Australia, but we were based in New Zealand, and it's a bad example of a big company because, again, like we just had this very small satellite office in this fairly scrappy country. With New Zealand has a what you would describe as a low power distance ratio, so it doesn't have like a very strict vertical hierarchy within a company. You know, your manager is close to being your friend or close to being your peer, as opposed to countries like in Asian countries, for example, where it would in the United States is further along that spectrum as well. So I honestly feel as though I don't think I noticed that much. I definitely noticed the technical execution. I mean, coming to San Francisco at that time, the quality of the engineering work was just so much higher, and you really had people who were really thinking about and defining best practices for the future rather than reading about them 5 years later. I think the world has shrunk a little bit since then, and the feedback loop is much shorter. Enterprises tend to adopt new technology much more quickly, relatively quickly compared to the sort of the delay from when cutting edge startups and small companies adopt these things or tech companies. So I think that was the biggest thing, was just working with people who were like really mind-blowingly smart and sort of thoughtful. And I do though think that this has changed. I think when I came to San Francisco, that was the height of San Francisco as a tech epicenter. I think since COVID that, you know, that's probably been been even accelerated even more, that it's decentralized. But I think even in the 10 years prior to that, there's just so much more happening in other parts of the world. And you had startups like Shopify in Canada and Spotify in Sweden, and, you know, all these other major success stories around the world. So I think that was the major thing at that time. You know, I showed up from New Zealand. I was working with a team of, I don't know what it was, 40 people or something, and very few of them were. I mean, I don't know if any of them were from the Bay Area, but like very few of them were even from the United States. It was, you know, just a lot of people who said, I want to go to that place because that's where I'm going to find a bunch of like-minded people. And I'm not sure that that's such a strong phenomenon anymore.
Absolutely. And I think as well, you said that despite being in a large corporate, you were in a small team. So you were wearing lots of different hats, which I guess was useful working at an early stage startup as well.
Right. I mean, that's just a very Kiwi thing. Like the biggest companies in New Zealand are very small, and you sort of, I don't know, there's a whole cultural philosophy around that, which I think rings true for the most part. You know, there's some cliches in there, number eight fencing wire and all this stuff, but there's definitely some truth in it as well.
And that kind of Kiwi relaxed attitude, non-hierarchical kind of approach.
Yeah. Relatively egalitarian, relatively non-hierarchical, and relatively sort of no bullshit. Although, I don't know, I work with some New Zealand companies now. We try and contract as much stuff there as we can. And I think it's a great market in terms of the price to quality ratio for software in particular. But I do notice now, having been here for 10 or 11 years, that when I deal with people there, I'm like, wow, they're so polite. Like, I wish we could just say what we really mean. So maybe I've adopted a little bit.
I do know what you mean. You kind of adapt. I'm obviously from the UK and I live in Australia now. And the approach here is different to living in London, for example, that people are kind of more polite and more chatty and more relationship driven, probably more similar to New Zealand, for example.
Yeah, it all comes from Britain for sure.
Yeah, absolutely. So Finn has recently raised $20 million. Tell me a bit more about your experience and the challenges in raising that capital.
Yeah, I don't want to sound dismissive of the challenges raising capital, but we didn't have a huge challenge on that particular round. We had pretty good numbers, and I don't know, how much of your audience has tried to raise this type of capital recently, venture capital, I mean, but it's never been this easy, particularly if you are in software as a service. There's just a ton of money flying around. And so, we had good numbers. We built a strong team. We had a lot of good indications. And so we were pretty lucky or pretty fortunate, however you want to think about it. And I think, like, despite my assertions earlier that there's sort of a decentralization happening around technology, I do still think that being in the Bay Area from a networking perspective gives you a lot of access to capital. Again, I don't want to be dismissive, but I wouldn't say that was as challenging as what it might be for some other folks, especially in other parts of the world. There's definitely still a distortion. I tend to think about this quite a lot because it seems like it has to fix itself at some point, in the sense that you can build great software products anywhere in the world, and people do. And increasingly, people are building great software companies as well. Booking.com in Amsterdam or TripAdvisor in the UK. Like, there's just these amazing unicorn tech startups popping up all over the world. And yet the availability of capital is not the same. I think that's probably a fairly non-controversial statement to say that it is a lot harder to raise capital for these types of ideas in parts of the world outside of the US, and even in parts of the US outside of California, or New York or Miami, maybe Austin. So I think that must change. There's just so much capital that is flowing into these types of businesses. And it makes sense as to why. I think this is, we're seeing a phase in the technology industry that was promised in the 90s and sort of took a longer time to come to fruition than everyone thought, but now it has come to fruition, and I think it's bigger than what at least the vast majority of people thought it could ever be. Just the sort of sheer size of the internet industry and the speed at which you can build a very profitable technology company. And it's funny, like, I say technology company, but most of the startups that you see that are doing extremely well, or they don't sell software. You can't buy software from Airbnb or Uber. They don't sell software. They're technology enabled disruptors that are disrupting traditional industries. And there's just a disconnect between your ability to do that anywhere in the world and then your ability to raise capital. So I do think that that'll change.
Absolutely. And I mean, Australia and New Zealand, I would have thought similar. It is much more difficult here to raise that capital. And do you think it's because, for example, here in Australia, New Zealand, we're more risk averse than maybe in San Francisco? Or is there just more money available?
So I think the risk aversion thing is not incorrect, but I think that's a symptom of the dynamic of the industry. So, the venture capital industry, the way it really works is that your best investments return so much from a multiples perspective that it then allows you to make a huge number of bets. If you have one Facebook in your portfolio, you can have 999 companies that don't succeed, or some number close to that. And so I think you look at a country like New Zealand, Xero is a really interesting example of a company that's done extremely well, and maybe that'll change the dynamic. a little bit, but before that, it's hard to point at any particular company that would have quote unquote returned a fund. Like you could say, oh, we invested in Facebook and that returned the fund, as if to say everything else we invested in was paid for by that single investment. Canva, you know, in Australia, I think raised $200 million recently at a $40 billion valuation, but that's a fairly late stage financing round. And then, you know, of course, it's led by a U.S. venture firm as well. So in some way, I think it is. And so, you know, the upshot of that is that then you don't have that the benefit doesn't necessarily come back in terms of maybe that venture firm or others that are in the round will, or even earlier stage investors will take that money and invest it a bit more liberally in Australian startups. I'm not sure. But yeah, I think it's important to like have some of those outsized returns in order to actually make the economics make sense. That's the only way that you can really turn around and, you know, give a couple of founders $1 million or $500,000 for an idea when they don't have any revenue yet. Like you can't go doing that all the time unless you have some winners.
Absolutely.
And there's a lot of pattern matching that goes on as well. Like you just, you know, if a lot of venture firms, they look at companies in San Francisco or Bay Area or anywhere in the United States, they know what they're looking for. They know the numbers they're looking for. They know the patterns they're looking for. They know the behaviors they're looking for in the founders and in the operators that are running the companies. And, you know, maybe some of that is not as well defined in certain other markets, especially smaller markets.
Absolutely. So talking about Finn,
sure.
Finn helps teams work better and more efficiently. How does it work? How does it make teams work better, more efficiently?
Yeah, so,
employees happier?
Yeah, so let me tell you a little bit about how Finn was started. So Finn is Finn.com, F-I-N.com. It's great. Three-letter domain name we somehow managed to get our hands on. Finn was actually started as a completely different business. So it was started as a virtual assistant business.
Okay.
It sounds funny, but so a couple of very successful consumer technologists, you mentioned their names earlier, Sam Lissa and Andrew Cortina, they started building this hybrid AI / human powered assistant. So if you imagine something like Siri or Alexa, but much more capable, because if the task proved too difficult for a machine to interpret, it would be handed to a human and a human would do it. And they were building this company and they ended up hiring hundreds of people to be fulfilling these tasks. And mostly they were across the United States. And as sort of software people, they had both built very large software platforms before. I mean, Sam had helped build Facebook, which is arguably one of the largest. And they just found that they had no idea what was going on. We don't know how these tasks are being completed. We don't know what the ROI is. We don't know how to train people better. We don't know where people are getting frustrated when they're trying to complete these tasks, what to price them at, so on and so forth. So they built this tool that essentially just understands what someone is doing as they use different applications throughout the day to complete tasks. And showed it to a few people and basically made the decision that, hey, this is a better product than what we're building. This thing that we've built for running our back office is better than the thing, or a better business than the thing that we're building. And so somewhere about this time last year, a little earlier, they went out to the market to try and find some folks that had experience running enterprise software companies. So basically business to business, go to market motion, and building enterprise sales. And so that's how I got involved. And, you know, you can describe, we call it a work insights platform, but really what Finn is doing is helping teams to understand how work is getting done. And in particular, we work with a lot of customer experience or customer operations teams. So customer support, inside sales, accounts receivable, teams that are quite large and doing work that is similar to one another. So if you think about a company like Airbnb, which is a customer of ours, they have many, many thousands of people that are helping their customers to deal with a certain, you know, set of issues, and they can figure out exactly what might be frustrating the agent, the employee. They call it the ambassador. What tooling they need, what tooling they have, what tooling they're using, whether they're following a certain path, and then ultimately extrapolating like, hey, we've been training everyone to do it this way. You know, Bob's doing it this way, and it looks like that's a better way to do it. Like we should figure out how to get everyone doing it that way, or whatever it is. There's a whole bunch of insights that the tool will actually spit out, but it's mostly about sort of introspecting and instrumenting and understanding how teams are getting work done through the course of the day.
That's fantastic. And where does the name Finn come from?
I think it was actually just like a clever name for a virtual assistant. So, I really like it. When I first heard it, I didn't know about the backstory of the company, and I assumed it was like, you know, the end of a film, like, you know, French film, whatever. And I was like, oh, it's like you guys are building the last software company that ever needs to exist. And Sam was like, oh yeah, of course, that's what it means. But the more I thought about it, I was like, actually, it's like, I bet it's just like Huckleberry Finn. It's like, you know, hey, Finn, can you book me a flight to New York or whatever? So yeah, I it's kind of maybe like we'll probably come up with some revisionist history one day about how it's something to do with the future of work and whatever else. But ultimately, it's just like a great, great brand name and a great domain name at this point.
Absolutely. And it's interesting as well how it morphed from one thing into something completely different.
Yeah, not uncommon in our industry. I don't know if you use Slack, but like Slack was built in almost exactly the same way. It was a gaming company. They built the chat. It was either for in-game chat or for chat like within the company, but that was not their product. There's quite a few examples of that where you call it like pivoting, basically. You know, a lot of times very early stage software companies will do such a pivot either because they can't, you know, what they're building is not what their customers end up telling them that they want, or just like in this case, it's a totally different example where it's like they built something for themselves and realized, oh wow, this is a big opportunity here.
Absolutely. And in fact, the platform that we're talking on, Odro, is a Scottish company, and it's interviewing software.
Oh yeah, video recording.
It was originally set up. The ODRO stands for Online Dispute Resolution something. I can't remember what the O stands for. But what it was for is when people were going through a divorce and they couldn't be in a room together, and that's what it was originally set up for. Anyway, it doesn't do that anymore. What it is recruitment video interviewing software.
That's cool.
So it's just there's so many stories, as you say, of pivoting and realizing where it would actually be more useful. So we've now all experienced working remotely. Pretty much everybody in the world has experienced this. So what do you think is the future of work?
It's a good question. Mm-hmm. I think you kind of hit the nail on the head. The notion that companies are inherently distributed makes a lot of sense for a lot of reasons. Mm-hmm. It's a new challenge. For sure. I think even for us, you know, we are a company who promotes distributed work as a core philosophy of our existence, not just for how we run our company, but, you know, for our product and what we're actually selling. I don't know if you saw this, but like GitLab's kind of, there's a couple of companies that are poster children of distributed work pre-COVID. And GitLab is, I think, certainly the most successful. They went public 2 weeks ago, I want to say, and had a very successful IPO, and they're now a $20 billion-ish odd dollar company. So, you know, the there's a lot of proof points out there. I'm not sure how many proof points there are outside of the software industry. Software and people building software tends to lend itself pretty well to distributed work. In fact, you know, a lot of the tools that you or I use every day, whether we know it or not, were built by distributed teams before distributed teams were a thing because they're open source projects. You know, so anyone using an Android phone is using the Linux kernel implicitly, and that's kind of the most famous open source distributed project. Mm-hmm. So there's a lot of precedent for this. I mean, I think the thing that will be interesting to me is there are just a lot of jobs that it doesn't work. I mean, you know, mm-hmm. there's the whole service and this whole service sector, and there's, you know, even things like civil engineering and things that involve physical, you know, interfacing with the physical world. So I'm like not exactly entirely sure how that plays out. And also I sort of think like it'll be curious to see the impact of that on social and economic inequality, in the sense that if you can live in a country that maybe has a smaller economy or a less valuable currency or whatever it is, and you can work for Google, how does that impact the economy of that country when someone else is working as a barista in that country and are bound purely to the economics of the local environment? So, you know, that's not an entirely new thing, but I think it's going to be accelerated. And I think it'll be interesting to see how that plays out. But, you know, I think the more interesting thing and the most interesting thing to me is we're all sort of becoming distributed now, or like a lot of companies, you know, were forced to become distributed in the last 2-3 years. But I'm particularly excited to just see what happens when people just are spinning up companies from all over the world with other people from all over the world with no historic grounding in, you know, any geographic centralization at all. So it's, you know, some kid in New Zealand co-founds a company with some kid in the Ukraine and they start hiring people all over the world. And it's, you know, that's cool. Like that I think is going to be super cool. And it just enables you to tackle so many more problems. There's certainly a trend, I think, right now in general with the internet where, and this is kind of one of the promises of the internet that took a little while to come true, but where niche businesses can become economically viable and meaningful. And some of that is like because of platforms like Shopify and Instagram for advertising, lower cost of creating software and deploying software using platforms like AWS. But, you know, you can go online now and buy just bizarrely niche products. And you know, presumably the companies that are running those products are at least have an eye to profitability. And I think like this sort of distributed first thing is going to multiply that and accelerate that, where there's going to be people all over the world with ideas that are seemingly extremely narrow, but who can find a small handful of people amongst the 7 billion people that could potentially work for them to go ahead and work on an idea. In the same way that the early internet really encouraged niche subcultures, right? It's like if you were really like interested in some obscure card game, like you could find a huge community of people online or a relatively large community of people online that would get into that with you, much larger than what you would find in, you know, if you were limited to folks living in your neighborhood in Brisbane. And I think you're going to see the same thing with entrepreneurship, where it's just like, I have this very narrow idea, but I don't have to convince the person that lives next door to me to help me with it. I can do community building and start building this thing completely distributed. So I'm excited about that.
Yeah, absolutely. I think a lot of it is kind of mindset and having a wider world view rather than just in your, you know, your own.
Well, there's also all these technological platforms as well. There's blockchain technology and what they call DAOs, distributed application organizations or something. I don't know what it stands for, but they're decentralized, whatever. There's all these technologies that are just going to make it so much simpler as well. And yeah, it's going to be cool.
Yeah. And I was talking to somebody in the UK earlier in the week, and they're in Manchester in the north of England, and they're competing for talent for those particular organizations. But companies in London, for example, and now recruiting people in the Ukraine because they're working remotely, and the people in the Ukraine are now earning 9-10 times what they were 18 months, 2 years ago, because you can that more remote first type approach. So it's interesting how it's creating, I don't know what the right word is, but it's making it very challenging to secure talent in a particular area as well.
I mean, arguably, it's removing arbitrage, like geographic arbitrage, which you would think overall is a good thing, and overall, it should actually reduce average sort of global pay. Mm-hmm. Well, no, it should bring the low pay rates up and the high pay rates down. But I don't know that that's going to happen because there's just so much more efficiency and like there's so much more value to be had from the internet in particular. That I don't see that happening anytime soon. I think it's just going to keep going up for a little while. And then that creates an interesting situation for people that aren't equipped to work in that industry.
Absolutely. I mean, obviously it's fabulous if you live in the Ukraine and you're being paid 10 times what you were 2 years ago. But yeah.
You know, unless you're like trying to you're not in that industry and you're trying to buy a house in, you know, Kiev or whatever, like, I don't know what the impact of that is, but
yeah,
you assume like over a long enough time that these things sort of pan out, but probably the industry will move a lot faster than the government will move.
Oh, absolutely. In terms of creating higher team performance, what do you believe really creates exceptional team performance?
I think there's a number of things, but first of all, I think it's really hard to get more out of a team than an excited team. But that's hardly like a management philosophy that's incredibly actionable most of the time. I think in terms of very actionable things, just having clear expectations. It's really hard to hold people accountable. It's really hard to push people hard. It's actually hard to reward people disproportionately if your expectation setting is not clear. We use a system called OKRs, which is very popular in the technology industry, objectives and key results, but we're pretty lax about most things, but we're pretty militant about that system in terms of making sure that everyone has ownership over things, that expectations are clear as far down the organization as we can make them clear, and that we're really diligent about making sure that those things are updated very frequently. The reason being that once you have that in place and expectations are clear, you really don't actually have to micromanage people anymore, which first of all sucks. No one likes it. Managers don't like it. Employees don't like it, but also is remarkably difficult to do when you're in a distributed environment. And so if you are able to just have clear expectations around outcomes or around inputs that are going to be achieved to a certain value, it just makes everything so much easier. It makes performance conversations so much easier. And all of a sudden, performance doesn't become a dirty word where, you're having your performance review and it's like, he said, she said, and just kind of everyone's confused. And, well, I thought I did a good job and I thought this and you thought that. It's like, okay, here's the five things that you signed up to do. Let's go look at how we did against them. And I think like that, when I say signed up to do, that's really important. When you're setting, like when I say expectations are clear, it's got to be clear bidirectionally from the employer to the manager and vice versa.
Absolutely. So having clarity on what the purpose and the outcome is, but not having, as you say, that micromanagement. So
yeah, it's like, I don't really care how you get there, but
yeah,
this is what you're signed up to do. There are exceptions to that. I mean, there always will be. And I think you tend to, as someone gets more senior, you tend to be more outcome driven, to the point where, like as a CEO, for example, it's like, I just am responsible for basically one number, which is a revenue number. I mean, there's a lot of other things that go into building a great company, but ultimately, it's very outcome driven. And I think simultaneously, like there's another parallel theme to that, which is as your organization gets more mature, you'll know what a person should be capable of in a certain role. So what an archetypal, software engineer should be able to achieve, or what an archetypal salesperson or whatever it is should be able to achieve. And so you can pretty much hold people to kind of benchmarks. But early on, you're not going to know that yet. And so you end up with a lot of input-driven measures. So rather than saying, we're going to get $1 million of pipeline this quarter, you might say, we're going to execute 10 marketing campaigns, because you don't actually know what's going to happen. You don't know what the benchmark is yet, but it's still a clear expectation. It's still something you can say, how did we achieve against that, and so on.
Absolutely, definitely. And Evan, you've got a really long career in entrepreneurship. Not really. Well, you've got...
I've actually never started a company, but I mean, I've worked with a lot of entrepreneurs. I've invested in a lot of entrepreneurs.
What advice would you give to aspiring entrepreneurs?
I mean, I think it's really, really hard to build a company where you are too far away from the problem, in the sense that, like, if you don't have a really personal relationship with the problem that you're trying to solve, it's too hard. I think people do it. Obviously there's people who start oil and gas companies or whatever, and I don't know how in love they are with oil and gas, but I think in general, it's draining, it's tiring, it's taxing, the whole world's against you. And so the closer of a relationship that you can have to that problem, more so than the solution. I think you want to be willing to be able to consider different solutions and not be hell-bent on executing some idea that first came to your mind from a solution perspective. But the closer you are to that problem, certainly the easier it is. And I think there's definitely a trend there, a correlation there towards long-term success. Mm-hmm. I think, that and just building and selling. I mean, that's essentially what you have to do. You have to build and you have to sell. And if you can build but can't sell, like, you need to find someone who can sell. If you can sell but can't build, you need to find someone who can build. And I think that's pretty much the same for every single industry. I think when I say sell, I don't just mean sell product. It's like you have to sell investors. You have to sell candidates, like candidate employees. And when I say build, I don't just mean build software. It's like, you got to build a brand. You got to build a cafe. Like, but ultimately those are sort of like the two actions that you're sort of doing, left foot, right foot. And so if you're not strong in both, you probably won't succeed in the sense that, and I don't mean that as an individual, but like as a team, you have to be strong in both.
Absolutely. Evan, you've had some real successes in your career. So what do you think are the secrets behind your success?
I don't know. No, I mean, I don't really feel that way. I mean, I think, like, we'll see. I mean, we should have this conversation in 5 years, but I I've been fortunate. I was very, very attracted to this industry when I was young, and it turned out to be an industry that had unbelievable growth and unbelievable returns. And it wasn't something where I had to go and teach myself as an adult, like how, the fundamentals of how the industry works or how the product itself works, the technology works. I just sort of had developed all that stuff. In saying that, it's funny, like, I've been coaching someone recently who graduated from business school and didn't have a technical background at all and was having a hard time getting a job. And I was just like, it's just teach you like how to program and just teach you data science and teach you some financial analysis stuff. And it's only taken like 5 months and this person's already like doing a whole bunch of stuff where I'm like, I don't know that, I stopped learning before that was a thing that became cool. Like, whether it's, some of the modern like machine learning stuff or whatever. So I actually don't think it takes that long to pick things up. I probably have a biased opinion here, but I do believe all companies are becoming technology companies, and it's really hard to have influence inside a technology company if you don't understand technology at a somewhat fundamental level. And I'm pretty much specifically referring to software here, although I think there's exceptions to that. But, I just think like that would be that's like my one thing. I'm like flabbergasted that you can get an MBA without learning to program. It's just astonishing to me. It makes absolutely no sense. And so it's really not that hard to learn just enough to be able to have a conversation with an engineer or a team lead or whatever, and know that what you're saying makes sense and know that what you're saying is conceptually reasonable and so on and so forth.
Absolutely. And it's interesting you say about most companies in the future will be technology companies. So a really good example of that would be, for example, Domino's Pizza Company. Yeah. And they don't sell themselves as a food company. They sell themselves as a technology company.
Yeah. If you look at the five most successful quote-unquote startups out of the Bay Area, I mean, there's exceptions to this. On the business-to-business side, there's still a lot of companies like Finn that build and sell software to their customers. But on the B2C side, it's, DoorDash, they're delivering food. It's Uber, they're, ostensibly a transportation company, or so it's Airbnb, like travel and accommodation. So it's, none of these companies are actually selling software. They're just using the economics and the technological leverage that you get out of software and out of the internet to transform industry. It seems very difficult for me to imagine that you could go and spin up a highly disruptive company in any industry today without having a bit of that. Even like, you think about Tesla, it's like there's less car than there is software in that thing. Mm-hmm. And, it's the fastest growing company really in recent times. So, and even the way you buy it, there's no dealerships. You just go online, everything's done just in time delivery. And, it's a technology company.
Yeah, absolutely. And one final question. If you could turn back the clock, would you do anything differently?
I would definitely buy more Tesla stock. while we're on the subject. No, we're going to get into a philosophical debate, but, you know, of course, but A, is it worth spending any mental or emotional energy on? And then B, mm-hmm. 10 years from now, would I look back at now and have the same perspective? And then does that make me qualified now to look back 10 years ago? And, you know, it's if I told you something now, I probably would be wrong again. So it's a tough one.
Absolutely. Yeah. And you kind of, if it didn't work out as well as it should have, for example, you learn from your mistakes. It's just if you keep doing it again and again and again that you want to do something differently, I suppose.
If you expose yourself to big enough opportunity, like you sort of increase your surface area for luck, you're going to have some luck. Like, you know, it would have been very hard to, not hard, but if you're in the San Francisco Bay Area and you're a software person that loves the industry, loves selling, loves building, whatever, and it's 2010, like, you're going to have to make some mistakes to not eventually have mm-hmm. some successes, because there's just so much success that came out of that era in that place. And so I think that continues to this day. You could say that what's going on in the creator economy, what's going on with blockchain, like what there's all these areas where it's just like, if you're there and you really understand it, like you're not just someone who's there talking about it, but you actually really deeply understand what's going on. You really analyze the situation, you learn from other people's mistakes, so on and so forth, expose yourself to the best talent and all that kind of stuff. I think you probably are going to end up successful or having some degree of success unless you really latch onto something and won't let go of it. Mm. That's a common mistake, is just not knowing when to say this thing isn't going to work.
Yeah, definitely. Well, thank you very much for sharing your insights, Evan. Is there anything else that you'd like to share?
No, I mean, you know, I enjoyed the conversation. We didn't spend too much time talking about Finn, but so my marketing team may not be super stoked, but so I should probably give a plug. It's Finn.com, F-I-N, and you know, you can basically follow me everywhere. Social media handle pretty much everywhere. It's just my last name, Cumac, C-U-M-M-A-C-K.
Perfect. Well, I shall post on social media about both Finn and yourself as well. And thank you very much. It's been a pleasure talking to you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
I hope that you enjoyed this episode. Please remember to subscribe, rate, and review. If you're looking for career advice, your next career opportunity, or to grow your tech team, then please call me, Nicola Steele, on 0499 773 546, or go to our website, jjptalent.com.au. The Don't Just Survive, Thrive podcast is part of the Spotlight series, which includes the YouTube channel, Spotlight on Software Development. If you want more insights into the software industry, particularly tech startups, then subscribe to the Spotlight on Software Development YouTube channel. Thank you for listening. Until next time.